I'm David Lazarus of the Los Angeles Times, in for Lizzie O'Leary. You're listening to Marketplace Weekend, where the economy meets real life. Lizzie's in Europe as part of Marketplace's Brexit coverage. We'll be hearing from her in just a little bit. This week, we're covering a lot of economic distance, from the aforementioned Brexit to, believe it or not, halfway across the solar system. Also, we continue our look at the welfare system 20 years after a major overhaul as Marketplace's Chrissy Clark takes us to Michigan and Indiana. And in this week's conversation, we'll be hearing your stories about the best bosses you've ever had and the worst. What puts them in the Hall of Fame? What puts them in the Hall of Shame? You got a story to tell? Tell it to us by visiting marketplace.org or chatting with us on Marketplace's Facebook page. Just do a search for Marketplace Business News. You can also call us at 1-800-648-5114. Let's start the show with some long and short. That's investment talk for thinking something's worth buying into, that would be long, or staying away from, which would be short. As in, I'm long internet searches, but I'm short having that info sold to marketers. You get it. So let's go long and short on some of this week's money-related news. We're joined by Zoe Schlanger. She's senior writer at Newsweek, and Marketplace's own Andy Euler. Welcome to you both.
Hey, great to be here.
Hey, David, how are you doing?
So let's go over to you, Zoe. Start us off. What are you long this week?
I am long this week on space and space travel. I don't know if you've noticed, but NASA's having a kick-ass week this week. They just did a nearly impossible task of slipping a solar-powered spaceship into orbit around Jupiter.
How awesome is that?
It's incredible. It's almost mind-boggling. My favorite detail from this story this week is that they are making it take a suicidal dive into Jupiter after a certain number of orbits so that it doesn't crash into a nearby moon called Europa that might have life on it, and they don't want to bring any Earth microbes into that.
Is getting to space easier? Am I in the dark here? What,
when you don't have people on board, it becomes exponentially easier.
Sure.
What I love about this story, though, to get to Jupiter, it was a five-year mission. And when it comes to five-year missions, that's Star Trek.
Right.
So, I mean, it's like so cool that we're on five-year missions into space already.
Crazy. And they came within 1 second of landing, the landing time they'd predicted.
Is there anything to this argument that we're not funding these sorts of projects, that NASA isn't actually getting the money that they need to get? Or is this proof that they're doing what they can with the money that they're getting? I mean, is there any sort of argument that we actually need to be funding them better?
Mm-hmm. I mean, I think one can only imagine what would happen if they're funded better. This exact mission only took $1.1 billion. And when you think about what's allocated for other things in this country, that's really relatively not a lot. But it does seem that they're having a good streak. They just extended 9 other missions about a week before making this Jupiter win.
I think there's also an argument to be made that we're so focused from a PR point of view on manned missions because you get a lot of PR value, but it's the unmanned missions where you get your science done.
Absolutely. There's way more experimentation. This is actually just the very first time we've flung something powered by the sun into deeper space. We've never done that before.
All right. Well, Andy, what are you long this week?
I am actually long on, it's a little closer than Jupiter. I'm long on Paris.
a lot closer than Jupiter.
but I'm long on Paris. There's a big, you know, after Brexit, there's been this kind of, it's not necessarily a fight, but Frankfurt has said, look, we want to be now the financial center of Europe. Paris is doing the same thing, and they're also writing letters to businesses saying, look, if you're going to leave London because you can't necessarily transfer people in and out of London anymore, with the kind of implications of what's happening with Brexit, then why don't you come to Paris? And my attitude is, sure. Why
not? Who says no to that question?
Exactly. Why not go to Paris? And part of the appeal to London was it was just a place that was fine, that everybody kind of knew, and that there wasn't anything specific about London in terms of being this financial center. It just kind of happened.
Well, actually, in the case of London, you had such an intense concentration because they're all in what's called the city.
Right.
And so they're all cheek by jowl there. And that had to have been a plus in some way, although I guess with technology, you don't really need that concentration.
Sure. And I think that's part of the argument with why do we need visas if we're going to go to London. I think there has been this argument that, look, we're just going to be able to figure this out. Nobody really has to leave London. So this talk of going to Paris, this talk of going to Frankfurt is really moot because, look, we can all go on the internet. We can do all the kind of transferring that we need to do. I think the argument for Paris is if you need to go and visit somebody who has a ton of money and they want kind of that interaction, then why don't you come here?
I wonder if there's an argument to be made for Brussels to be the new financial center, since the Europeans want to create a Eurocentric environment, and Brussels is where the European Parliament is based.
It's funny that Brussels was never really brought up. It's just seen as kind of the political center and not really in terms of what's happening in business. It was always Frankfurt. And then they said, ah, Frankfurt's not very much fun. So why don't we think about Paris? And then Paris, I think, got on board and said, you know what? Why don't we think about Paris?
Okay, well, let's switch over. So now we're going to go into short, and like we said before, short means this is kind of stuff we've got questions about. We're a little bit dubious here. Zoe, what are you short on?
Well, bear with me here, and I hope you're not eating breakfast, but I am short on poop. Poop at the Olympics.
Okay, let's roll that back just a moment. Zoe, you're short on what?
I'm short on sewage sludge, raw sewage flowing into the waterways the Olympics.
What's the problem?
So the problem is that there is a ton of fecal matter that flows into the waterways where people will be competing. Athletes will be swimming. Rowers will be rowing, splashing water in their faces, ingesting water. It's the nature of the sport. And there's millions and millions of viruses. And now we've just found a super bacteria in this water. And this is a huge deal. Athletes are concerned. They're getting sick while training. And the AP, for example, just sampled some water a while ago and found that it was about 1.7 million times what would be considered hazardous at a beach in California.
I believe the medical term here is grody.
It's mad grody.
But is it safe? I mean, you know, if you ingest these super bacterias and these super high levels of fecal matter, are people going to die?
You might not die, but you might get very, very sick. It would actually probably depend on what you were ingesting and how much. But it seems, according to one expert at the University of Texas, she said that if a swimmer ingested just 3 teaspoons of this water, they had a 99% chance of developing some sort of infection. And the reason I'm short on this, I mean, this is a huge deal, but the reason I'm short on it is because the whole world has been dealing with this forever, and no one's really thought about it or talked about it. I mean, 90% of the developing world's sewage right now is currently dumped directly into waterways untreated.
That's exactly what I was going to ask kind of immediately was, is there any positive? I know I might be looking at the kind of the sunny side of this, but is there any positive in that? I think it's front and center now because there are athletes that are actually going to be interacting with this water. But is it a matter of, I mean, can we take a positive and say, look, Rio, you guys have to figure this out right now. And if we're going to be throwing money at the Olympics, figure out your water, right?
Yeah, there's a lot of pressure. I mean, we're coming down to the wire with this. They don't have a lot of time. They had planned, they said they had promised to build 8 sanitation plants. They built one. And they're now fully admitting that they're not going to have the water quality where it was supposed to be for the Olympics. But the attention is always a good thing. I mean, the pressure is certainly on. We can see what happened with the Beijing Olympics. The air was, at least temporarily, quite thoroughly cleaned up, and people were talking about it in a way they never talked about it.
Well, I find that particularly interesting, that the Olympics is spotlighting these environmental hazards. In the one case of Beijing, air you can't breathe, and here we have Rio, water you can't drink or swim in. It really spotlights not the glory of athletic competition, which is what these things should be about, but rather, look what we're doing to our planet.
It's interesting the approach Brazil is now taking with this, though, because it'll be interesting to watch what they do. They're talking now about pushing to privatize the water infrastructure, so that there's private money flowing in to fix things. Of course, this comes with its own complications.
Now, we've been seeing that throughout the developing world, as a matter of fact. So, Andy, what are you short of?
I know I feel kind of bad about where I'm short because we were just talking about celebrating the triumphs of a solar vehicle getting to Jupiter. That is great.
It's cool.
I'm short on solar power, and I'll break it down. Okay, if solar power is getting cheaper and it's getting easier and the construction is, you know, just kind of more readily available, why doesn't everybody now have solar power? Why don't all businesses convert to that? Is it just that it's too expensive? Is it too complicated? Is it money?
It's partially money. I mean, solar arrays on personal homes and small businesses are super expensive still. We have not been able to bring that down. Like, for example, China has brought down the price considerably, but we're not necessarily importing those solar panels. So we're relying on American technology, which is more expensive. But it is a matter of scale. I mean, one thing that is dropping in price is the very large scale arrays. So getting your solar power from a huge array out in the desert that's mm-hmm. feeding into the power grid is coming down. That price is coming down. But just installing it on your house, that's still wildly expensive.
And to put numbers on that, it's something like $10,000 up front to put solar panels on top of the typical residence. And then once you do it, to get it paid off with the cheaper electricity that comes out, that can be anywhere from a 10 to 15 year window.
Right.
So for a lot of families, that's a real challenge. You really have to be totally committed long term for that sort of thing. It's odd that we haven't been able to find technologies that are both more efficient in terms of processing the solar energy and also more cost effective.
Definitely. I think that'll be a matter of subsidies in research, for example. I mean, I know some people are finding ways to make flexible paint-on solar panels. And if we could jumpstart, just put a ton of money into R&D, I have a feeling we'd figure something out.
But aren't there, at the same time, it seems like there are opportunities in... I know India does a ton of work in solar because they're trying to get solar PV solar to folks that don't have any electricity at all. And so they're saying this is an opportunity to bring solar to folks that aren't necessarily on the grid. You can set up your own kind of solar panel. I know there's been a ton of research being done where it could theoretically help developing countries, developing communities get electricity where they didn't have it before. Now it sounds like I'm not all that short on solar. Maybe I'm short on solar in America. But there is, it seems like, this opportunity to figure it out. It just seems like we've been reading and hearing about how quickly solar is here, how cheap it's gotten, and I'm just not seeing that kind of being manifested in our reality, I guess.
Well, it seems to me that if we can put solar panels on Jupiter, we can put them on a lot more homes.
You would think, right?
Right. Yeah. Just the bottom line there. All right, that's been the long and the short of it for this week. My thanks to Zoe Schlanger, senior writer at Newsweek, and Marketplace's Andy Euler. Thank you to you both.
Thanks a lot.
No, thank you, David.
Lizzie is overseas as part of Marketplace's continuing Brexit coverage. On last week's show, she reported from the industrial town of St. Helens in northwest England, a place that voted heavily to leave the European Union. This week, she traveled to St. Helens' sister city, Stuttgart, Germany. The sister city arrangement was made not long after World War II. St. Helens produced glass, and Stuttgart, which had been heavily bombed during the war, needed glass, and lots of it. But as St. Helens' fortunes declined in the post-war period, Stuttgart's rose. Impressively, it now has one of the lowest unemployment rates in Germany. Lizzie went there to figure out what makes Stuttgart so successful and how people there feel about the EU.
Stuttgart is St. Helens' sister city, but there's little resemblance. Just take a walk down this impeccably clean street with boutiques, restaurants, modern buildings, and a violinist playing for change. And sibling opinions on Brexit, to stay with the metaphor, could not be more different.
I feel sorry for the English that they made such a decision.
That's Gunter. He's retired and was sipping a beer at a sidewalk cafe. He used to be an accountant, and he didn't want to give his last name, which is pretty common here.
We need a union. We don't need customs. We don't need borders. We need freedom of movement. We need to be able to choose where we work. And we can only have these things in a unified Europe.
That idea of a unified Europe with people moving back and forth clearly didn't fly with voters in St. Helens. But it's the bedrock of the economy here. 45% of people in Stuttgart are either foreign-born or the children of immigrants. And they've been coming here since the 1950s. To work at some of the most famous companies in Germany.
Very great international companies like Mercedes, Porsche, Bosch.
It's Andreas Richter's job to promote those companies. He runs the Chamber of Commerce. He says people come here because the wages are high, the schools are good, and Germany wants them to come. It has an aging population and it needs skilled workers.
You know, my wife and me, we have 4 children. This is a very rare decision. So it's a demographic problem in Germany in total. We have now, like Japan, one of the oldest populations. So we have a lot of business to do, but we have not enough people to do the business.
One aspect of prosperity that is immediately evident here, well, you can see it in the cars. Every car we've seen is in impeccable shape, and they're all really nice. Audis, BMWs, Porsches, Mercedes, Mercedes taxis even seem to be the car of choice. That's music to the ears of Daimler, Mercedes' parent company. That single-cylinder engine you just heard is from 1886. It's in the Mercedes-Benz Museum here. It's hard to walk past rows of shiny cars and exhibits about technology and not think of the Glass Museum back in St. Helens. That museum was largely about the past, an industry that's lost thousands of jobs in the last few decades. This one is about a company with 170,000 people working in Germany alone. As visitors leave, they see a digital screen projecting the phrase, "Can I contribute to the future?" over an image of themselves. And yeah, it's corporate messaging. But the people here seem to feel that way too. Angelika was walking her two young kids down the street in Stuttgart. I asked her what kind of Europe she wants for them in the future. Here's what she said.
I think it should be free for them to move and to live and to work.
I think it makes Europe bigger and more unified. I now feel more European than just simply being German.
In Stuttgart, I'm Lizzie O'Leary from Marketplace.
Next week, we'll hear more from Lizzie about her coverage of Europe's economic and political turmoil and visit some new places and meet some new people. Last week, we asked you to tell us about the best boss you've ever had, or the worst. What made him or her a pleasure to work for, or a nightmare? Listener Michael Cabus reached out to us on Twitter. He left the world of academia for a tech startup.
I was working in higher education. I was working as a librarian. Right now, I'm working as a UX designer, and I'm in marketing for an e-commerce company called Tectocommerce.
So tell me how having an analog academic boss is different from having a digital boss.
Well, the analog boss, I found often in that situation there were sometimes barriers to communication. And sometimes there was, in higher ed, there seemed to be a lot of red tape going on, and it was hard to sort of get things done sometimes because there were so many barriers and so many permissions needed to sort of get something finished. And so you would often be in the situation where you have to communicate with many different people to get to an end result. You would often find yourself trying to navigate, you know, personalities and moods a lot and sort of territories and things like that.
And now that you work for a tech company, how is it different?
I feel like it's more of a startup environment where we're all sort of collaborating. Our office is very open, and so my boss sits in an office, but his door is always open. And so I feel like I can sort of pose an idea, and it sort of navigates around the office better in terms of the bosses and other people. And so I feel more free to share my ideas and work with others.
Our next listener is Taylor Kaufman, who also comes to us via Twitter. She works at Southern California public radio station KPCC, which is a part of APM. She's a project coordinator and moonlights as an actor. Hi, Taylor.
Hi.
All right, so we're talking bosses here. Without naming names, unless you want to, is there a boss you particularly loved or hated?
I would say right now, my boss at KPCC, Mark Rowley, is by far the best boss I've ever had. So I'm very lucky with where I'm at. He's the reason I'm there. I actually even work with an ex-boyfriend, and I have not left because I love my boss so much.
So you're not just sucking up.
No, I'm not. And he knows it, too. I mean, I just think that, like, yeah, he's very supportive. And then, but he's also good at giving space, so you can sort of do your job. He really counts on putting the right people in the right places.
How important is that to you as the subordinate to somebody to be given some space and to be given a long enough leash to actually look after your own affairs?
I think it is important because it really makes you take on your own personal responsibility. You know, you don't have someone looking over your shoulder, so it's really up to you to get it done. And I think if you're the kind of person that doesn't need a lot of hand-holding, which I think everyone, you know, in their career at some point can sort of let go of the leash a little bit and take a little more personal responsibility. But it also makes you take that responsibility.
You also work as an actress, which means you're working with directors. And
right.
directors, you know, in my mind, we get that Cecil B. DeMille kind of right. megalomaniacal kind of thing.
Right.
Is it challenging to work with someone who has a vision for a project that you have to deliver?
Yes and no. I think it depends on whether or not you understand that vision. And I think that that's true in any career. If you understand the vision that the artist or the director is crafting or on board with that, it's then you're just serving the team. If that vision is convoluted or not clear or not communicated, it's really hard to give people what they want. And I think that's something that just transcends any career.
Okay, again, without necessarily naming names, tell me about a bad boss you've had.
You know, I have friends who have nightmare stories, and I'm lucky enough not to have a nightmare story about a boss. But I do think I've had very passive-aggressive bosses who were maybe not so great at giving feedback, so they just didn't give any. And then, you know, you would be striving for communication, but wouldn't be getting it. But you'd often hear from somebody else, you know, another coworker, that your boss didn't like X, Y, and Z. And sometimes you're like, well, I would have really loved to hear that from you, because really, honestly, we all do want to, you know, serve the mission, serve the team. And when we're not giving the tools or communicated with, that could be a really challenging position to be in.
Taylor Kaufman, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks.
Have your own boss story to share or questions about how you could be a better manager? We're continuing this conversation on next week's show. So give us a call at 1-800-648-5114 or send us a message on Facebook. Just do a search for Marketplace Business News. Years ago this August, the U.S. enacted welfare reform. It changed the welfare program as we know it, creating a system with work requirements and time limits on how long you could receive support. Funded by federal block grants to states, it became known as TANF, Temporary Assistance to Needy Families. So, what do we know now about how welfare operates? That's the focus of our newest podcast. It's from our Wealth and Poverty Desk and is called The Uncertain Hour. Marketplace's Chrissy Clark has been traveling the country, looking at how states are spending welfare dollars. We'll be making two stops today. First up, Michigan.
Explain, for somebody who can't see what's going on right now, what the hell is going on right now?
Okay, so I guess you call it a rave dance. There's people out here dancing and having fun with some glow lights right in front of them.
I'm in a dark gymnasium on the campus of Adrian College, an expensive private college in southeastern Michigan. It's crazy in here. There are students engulfed in giant plastic bubbles playing soccer, students squirting glow-in-the-dark paint at each other.
And then Hunger Games archery with toy arrows.
Now, it just so happens, except hold that thought, I'm going to break the fourth wall and turn down the rave music a little because it's hurting my brain. Much better. Now, it just so happens that many of the people at this college-sponsored rave party are 20 years old, meaning they were born the same year that welfare reform was born. So in between glow paint wars and bubble soccer and Taylor Swift songs, I was curious to know from these guys, what comes to mind when you hear the word welfare? What do you know about welfare?
Welfare?
I think of like a welfare check.
It's good for some people, but there's times where welfare is bad because it's just turning around into drug money or right to the liquor store.
But here's the thing. All those students who just answered my question, they didn't know it until I told them, but actually, they are on welfare too. Once upon a time, welfare was basically a program where the federal government sent monthly welfare checks to families based on economic need. But with welfare reform and the new block grant system,
what Bill Clinton and Congress did was told the states, you get a certain amount of money and you set up your own programs.
Here's senior analyst Peter Ruark with the Michigan League for Public Policy.
And you can spend this money as long as it fits under four purposes.
Purpose one,
to provide assistance to needy families.
Basically what we think of as welfare. Purpose two,
to end the dependence of needy parents on government benefits by promoting job preparation and work.
Purpose three,
to prevent and reduce out-of-wedlock pregnancies.
And purpose four,
to encourage the formation of two-parent families.
And those four purposes, written into the 1996 welfare reform law, have been interpreted in some interesting ways. So much so that today, only a fraction of the money, just about a quarter nationwide, actually goes to cash assistance for poor families anymore. And the rest goes to
everything but the kitchen sink. I mean, it's a big slush fund.
Some of that money shows up at private colleges in Michigan, like Adrian College, where that glow-in-the-dark party happened. Of the 1,700 students who go there, who mostly grew up in middle-class or upper-middle-class families, more than half receive money from the Temporary Assistance for Needy Families Block Grant. That is, federal welfare money, to help cover their nearly $45,000 a year tuition. Kelly Zekin is a junior at Adrian.
I am an accounting major.
And one of these unwitting welfare recipients. The money she gets comes through a program called the Michigan Tuition Grant. It's specifically targeted to Michigan students who go to private colleges in-state, takes into account how much their families make compared to how expensive a school is. Kelly gets about $1,800 a year from the tuition grant, which she's grateful for.
Free money, I guess, is kind of the running joke in our house. But, you know, I didn't know exactly what qualified me for it. I hadn't really looked much into it.
I did look deeper into the Michigan tuition grant, and here's how it works. Remember those four purposes that I mentioned earlier that restrict what states can spend their welfare block grants on?
Well, I found a pie chart, and it's quite interesting.
That's policy analyst Peter Ruark again, the kind of guy who appreciates a good pie chart. But this is the kind of pie chart that actually any taxpayer should find quite interesting, since it's all about how federal tax dollars, dollars that go towards one of the most controversial programs around, welfare, are spent.
What we see is only 12% of that federal funding in Michigan goes toward welfare payments.
That is, basic cash assistance to poor families. Meanwhile, in Michigan, almost three times as much, 33%, goes toward
out-of-wedlock pregnancy prevention,
which is one of the four purposes that states can spend welfare dollars on.
But this out-of-wedlock pregnancy prevention, listeners to the show might not guess that that includes financial aid for going to college.
Wait, what? that's a convoluted set of dots.
Yes, yes.
But connected those dots are. As of this year, Michigan puts almost $100 million of its more than $700 million TANF block grant towards in-state college-granted scholarship programs, all in the name of preventing out-of-wedlock pregnancy. And there's another reason this welfare spending on college financial aid is worth examining.
Some of this financial aid does not go toward low-income families. There's actually quite a bit of it that goes to upper-middle-class families.
In fact, according to the most available data, about 6% of the Michigan tuition grant, which is funded by $34 million of federal welfare money, 6% of that goes to students whose families earn more than $100,000 a year.
Hi, Debbie.
How are you? Yeah.
Nice to meet you. I'm Chrissy.
Hi, nice to meet you.
Hi. Thanks
Debbie
so much
Petersmark lives in East Lansing, Michigan, on a tree-lined suburban street where she and her ex-husband, Mike, raised their three kids. Their oldest, Andy, just finished his sophomore year at Adrian College. And he receives a Michigan tuition grant funded by temporary assistance for needy families. The Peters Marks do not fit the typical definition of a needy family. Mike's a CPA. Debbie sells ads for a local TV station. Together, they fall into the upper end of earners in America, more than $200,000 a year. But even when you make that much money, college can be expensive, especially a private college like Adrian.
You're basically, with college, you're basically buying a brand new car every year that you have to pay in full for it right then.
And when I tell Mike and Debbie that some of the financial aid their son gets is welfare money,
I personally think it's terrific because just because a kid grows up in a home that might have a little bit more money than the next doesn't mean that they're not entitled to some help from the government for college. I mean, it doesn't matter how much money you make. You're still forking over $30,000 a year for college is a hardship.
You can hear the rest of the story and how Michigan explains the link between college scholarships and out-of-wedlock pregnancy prevention on our podcast, The Uncertain Hour.
More on welfare reform in just a moment. But first, well, we like our numbers here at Marketplace. Yeah, and go ahead, call us nerds. We can take it. Let's look now at some of the biggest numbers from this week's news stories. Here are Marketplace producers Tony Wagner and Eliza Mills. Tony?
Thanks, David. 58. That's the percentage of Americans who distrust Wall Street, according to our latest economic anxiety survey with Edison Research.
That feeling was most prevalent among African Americans and those identifying as Democrats, but the sentiment cuts across all races and political leanings.
Majorities in every group also said they thought the economy was rigged in some way.
Just over $687.
That's how many dollars a round trip from the U.S. to London cost on average last weekend, according to our partners at Quartz.
Hopper, an airfare tracker, says ticket prices have dropped 14% since the Brexit vote.
The deals probably won't last, though, since a lot of people are likely thinking a trip to London sounds pretty good right now.
24.
That's the absolute maximum life of a photo or video on Snapchat, though most are gone in seconds. It's kind of the app's main feature.
At least it was until this week. Snapchat just announced Memories, a tool for storing, searching, and reposting old snaps.
It's a huge new feature that will likely bring more people to the app. But some worry Snapchat is ruining the spontaneity that made people love it in the first place.
And don't forget, it makes a lot more room for ads.
Oh, yay.
Now let's continue our cross-country road trip looking at how states are spending their welfare dollars. Welfare is now known as Temporary Assistance for Needy Families. That program, TANF, turns 20 years old next month, the anniversary of when welfare reform passed. These days, states receive federal block grants and can choose how to spend welfare dollars as long as it fits within certain parameters. Marketplace's Chrissy Clark, as part of our newest podcast, The Uncertain Hour, has been looking into how that money is used. Next stop, Indiana.
I've just pulled into the parking lot of a CVS pharmacy to look at a billboard. Bright pink background with the close-up of a concerned-seeming woman looking into the distance.
It says, pregnant, we can help. Then it gives their phone number, and at the bottom it just says, Women's Care Center, free ultrasounds, free pregnancy tests.
The person showing me this billboard is Brandy David, 26 years old, works as a property researcher at a title company. One day, 2 years ago, she called that phone number when she found herself pregnant and needing help.
My first thought was, oh my God, damn it, no. Just all of those things, just all at once. I'd been using protection, and I was just like, why? Why? Why?
Brandy was in her first year of graduate school, barely making ends meet already. And she says she immediately knew she was in no position to have a baby.
I couldn't afford it. I was not dating the gentleman in question. I'm already in the hole from student debt while I'm in school.
Brandy says she knew she wanted an abortion, and she thought she knew where she could get one. Women's Care Center, that place with the billboard she kept driving by. Brandy set up an appointment, came in as soon as she could.
And it's set up in this beautiful old house, very homey. I walked in and saw how pink and fluffy everything in that room was.
At the appointment, she made it clear why she was there.
The lady was very friendly, supportive, but when I said that I wanted an abortion, she kind of shied away from that. She would just kind of keep telling me, like, well, we can get to that. Adoption's an option. There are other things that we can talk about, and, you know, we'll get to that sooner or later.
But her counselor never did get to that. In fact, Brandy didn't know it at the time, but there was no way she would receive an abortion at Women's Care Center or even get a referral for an abortion. Because it turns out Women's Care Center is what some call a crisis pregnancy center, a pregnancy resource center with a specific mission that includes steering women away from having an abortion. It also turns out the place Brandy went to and its anti-abortion efforts have been partly funded since late 2014 by a small percentage of federal welfare dollars through the program Temporary Assistance for Needy Families. Now, before we go any further, let me acknowledge that abortion is one of those intense emotional issues that probably every one of you listening right now has strong feelings about. Right now, in this story, we're going to look at a very specific question, the role of spending some federal welfare money on these alternative to abortion centers. Centers like this one.
So this is just our waiting room.
Jenny Hunsberger is vice president of Women's Care Center. Earlier this spring, she showed me around one of the offices they have in South Bend. Brandy was right. It is very pink, very homey.
We just want people to feel welcomed and cared for and comfortable and safe.
Jenny tells me this network of women's care centers has been around for more than 30 years. The typical client is poor.
Almost all qualify for federal programs like Medicaid. Nearly 80% are single moms. 25% don't have a high school diploma. 40% are fully unemployed. So our clients have hard lives.
I asked her, if a woman like Brandy, the grad student, feels like she just can't afford to have a child and says she wants an abortion, would you refer them to an abortion clinic?
What I would say is we would be here if any woman said that. Whatever a woman says, we would say to her, we are here for you before your decision, during your decision, and after your decision, regardless of what your decision is.
But am I correct that you would not refer them?
What I would say is that what we say to women is we are here for you before, during, and after. And the decision is yours.
But I just want to make sure I'm clear. But would you ever refer them to a clinic? No.
Correct. Or am I wrong? I wrong?
What I would say is we would be here for you. And what I would say to a woman is I would be here for you before, during, and after the decision is yours.
So you're not going to give me the information, but you will tell me that you will be here for me.
We will be here for you. We will be here for you always. We are here to serve you.
And though Jenny wouldn't say it explicitly, it's written into the contract with the state of Indiana that in order to receive TANF money, federal welfare money, centers like hers are forbidden from referring people to abortion clinics. Those are the conditions of their government funding. In case you were wondering, current law prevents federal money of any kind from funding abortions, except in cases of rape or incest or when the pregnancy will endanger the woman's life. But here in Indiana, the state spends federal money on efforts to steer women away from abortions. Specifically, over the last year, it's allocated $3.5 million federal welfare dollars to organizations like Women's Care Center. There's a common critique of single mothers on welfare that goes like this. If you're too poor to support a child, you shouldn't be having one in the first place. And so I asked Jenny why welfare dollars should be used to help and encourage poor, often single mothers, to have children. She said her program is more than that.
It really helps build families that are more self-sufficient, families that have more opportunity. So in that way, it's very appropriate.
The center also actively connects women to charities and government services.
Make sure that she has all of the resources she needs to navigate the Medicaid system, that she signed up for WIC, which is the Federal Nutrition Program for Pregnant Women and Children.
And food stamps, and of course, cash welfare. Indiana isn't the only state that puts federal welfare dollars towards alternative to abortion centers like Jenny's. So do Texas, Missouri, North Dakota, Ohio, and Pennsylvania. That's where the whole idea got its start, with a nonprofit organization called Real Alternatives. We reached out repeatedly to Real Alternatives for an interview, but they declined. Jerry Bermelin was a Republican state legislator in Pennsylvania when the idea for Real Alternatives was born.
We, in the pro-life movement, saw that there was TANF funds available, and that was one of the reasons why we created the organization, is because we knew that it could access the TANF funding.
That is, Temporary Assistance for Needy Families funding. As Jerry said this,
it could access the TANF funding.
I wondered how states justified putting welfare money into alternative to abortion programs. On the one hand, these programs do provide assistance to poor pregnant women and their soon-to-be families. On the other hand, these programs often encourage poor, single women to have kids, when one of the explicit goals of federal welfare reform was to promote the formation of two-parent families. I asked Jerry Bermelin about all this.
Yeah, and I don't think the answer is ever to kill the children just so they don't have to be on welfare. I don't agree with that philosophy. I think life is very precious and ought to be protected, and Real Alternatives helps to do that. And I do not accept the argument that we should just have them have their abortion so they're not on welfare. I feel that's very dehumanizing.
Jerry's also a fiscal conservative. He believes in limited government spending, shrinking government programs. So, yes, he thinks that it makes sense for welfare dollars to go to alternative to abortion centers. But he cautions,
it's not the taxpayers' responsibility to raise everybody's children for them, and I'm not suggesting that. What I'm suggesting is if you go through a crisis pregnancy and you really need help for a short period of time, usually it's only a few months, and I think we should be in the business of helping these people through those crisis pregnancies and getting them back on their feet.
And in doing that, the umbrella group Real Alternatives says they save taxpayers millions of dollars by connecting women with things like prenatal care and immunizations. When I told Brandy David, who went to the Women's Care Center thinking she could get information about an abortion there, that it was funded partly by welfare dollars, she was surprised.
That's just not okay, dude. Like, find something else. Like, there are a million other things that it could go to. It could go to supporting the children that are a result of this.
As for Brandy's particular situation, she did eventually realize that Women's Care Center was not going to help her with an abortion. She called a Planned Parenthood in another state to help her find a clinic that would. I'm Chrissy Clark for Marketplace.
You can subscribe to The Uncertain Hour wherever you get your podcasts. And if you're wondering about how your state spends its welfare dollars, you can find out by visiting marketplace.org. We're on the south side of the show. That reference will become clear in just a moment. And it's time for our Marketplace quiz. We bring in musicians, writers, and others in the spotlight, and we have them answer questions about work and money, how it shaped their lives or taught them important lessons. Here's Marketplace producer Raghu Manavalan with this week's guest.
Hi, I'm Moby, and I'm a musician, and I guess now I'm an author, sort of, as well.
So first question, in a next life, what would your career be?
Either I would lead whitewater rafting trips through the Grand Canyon, or I would be the first democratically elected dictator of the entire world.
Those are two very different careers.
Yeah, or maybe both at the same time.
What is the hardest part about your job that no one knows?
One is how solitary it is. And I'm not really complaining, but I do envy people who work in more gregarious environments because, you know, the things that I focus on, whether it's writing or making music, I do exclusively by myself. And so I think of, you know, musicians who are in bands or people who are comedy writers on comedy shows or anything that's more collaborative and gregarious. And I sort of envy them being able to work in a convivial environment as opposed to, you know, sad, isolated, you know, ascetic me stuck in my studio.
Do you feel like when you get to collaborate with other musicians and stuff that it kind of scratches that itch of teamwork, or is it still kind of a solitary
endeavor.
One of the other consequences of working in a very solitary way is that when you actually do encounter other people, you don't really know what to do with them. And I'll have this experience with my girlfriend sometimes. Like, I'll spend the entire day working by myself, and by 6 o'clock realize I haven't spoken to another person all day, and I'll see my girlfriend and I will almost have forgotten how to speak.
Wow.
So I'll need like a couple of minutes of, you know, so reacclimation to remember what it's like to actually be in the presence of real people.
When did you realize music could be an actual paying career?
I think it would have been around 1989, which is actually the beginning of my book, Porcelain. And I was only making $3,000 a year, but I was living in an abandoned factory with no running water, and I was living in a crack neighborhood, but I made enough money from DJing that I could afford to pay the security guards at this abandoned factory $50 a month to look the other way.
Wow.
And I was spending around $5 to $10 a week on food. So at that point, I learned that I could have, like, music could be a paying career, even though it was only paying me $3,000 a year.
What is your most prized possession?
I have this weird lamp that looks like a squirrel. And I bought it, I don't know, 15 years ago in a junk shop. I then had this crazy house in upstate New York. It was like my degenerate party palace, and it was on 65 acres, and it was three houses all totaled. The main house was around 12,000 square feet, and I built a disco in the house and built a spa in the house, and it was where my friends from New York would hang out and just have all sorts of alcohol-fueled degeneracy. And then I got sober, and I sold this compound, and the only thing I took with me from the compound was this squirrel lamp.
That's
and
awesome.
This squirrel lamp kind of goes with me everywhere. I mean, I feel a little bit like Steve Martin in The Jerk, you know, like when all he needs is his thermos when he's leaving his palace. So my equivalent of Steve Martin in The Jerk with his thermos is me with my little strange squirrel lamp.
What is something you bought that you now completely regret buying?
The one purchase that I do regret was at one point right before I got sober. And maybe I shouldn't say this, because the last time I talked about drugs publicly, I lost my life insurance policy. I did buy way too much cocaine. But in a way, it wasn't regrettable, because I remember looking up in my apartment at 5 o'clock in the morning, and my apartment was filled with people who were only hanging out there to do the cocaine that I had bought. And I realized that my life was just terrible. You know, I was surrounded with these awful people who I knew were only there for the, you know, the $1,000 of cocaine that I had bought. So it was disgusting and regrettable, but it also helped me to get sober, so I can't regret it too much.
What advice do you wish someone gave you before you started your career?
I think the only advice would be, you know, in the course of your life, you're going to make a ton of mistakes. Just accept that it most likely is going to end up in a good place. Because in the course of my life, I've made countless mistakes. I mean, huge, you know, career-destroying, soul-shattering mistakes. But the cumulative effect of all those mistakes is me as I sit here right now. And I'm actually quite grateful for the life that I have. And I'm really happy with the perspective that I have. And I wouldn't have this life in perspective without all of those mistakes.
Moby's memoir, Porcelain, is out now.
In my dreams, I'm dying all the time.
And that's our show for this week. Next week, Marketplace's Adrian Hill holds down the fort as Lizzie continues her Brexit reporting. Also, we'll be continuing our conversation on bosses, good and bad. What makes them great or not so great? You can let us know by visiting marketplace.org, chat with us on Marketplace's Facebook page, just search for Marketplace Business News, or you can call us at 1-800-648-5114. And remember, your voice may be featured on the air, so be nice. Marketplace Weekend is produced by Eliza Mills and Raghu Manavalan. Dan Samitovich is our senior producer. Bill Lance is our engineer. Our theme music is composed by Naren Rao. Sitara Nieves is Marketplace's executive producer. Deborah Clark is our vice president. I'm David Lazarus of the Los Angeles Times, and until next time, I'll see you in the business section. This is APM.